I'm Lee Harris, President and CEO of Cohen Esri, and you are listening to the Cohen Esri Apartment Investors Podcast. Usually our fund manager, Lydia Kincaid, is our moderator, but I'm pleased to announce that Lydia recently had a baby and is on maternity leave for the next several weeks. So I will try to fill her shoes for the time being. Today we have Ryan Huffman, Managing Director of CEAI, Cohen Esri Apartment Investors, and he's the Chief Operating Officer of Cohen Esri, as well as Phil Melton, Managing Director of Cohen Esri Capital Partners, our capital formation unit. During this podcast, we're going to talk about debt for apartment properties. And so, Ryan, I would like to start with you talking about how we go about analyzing and securing debt when we're acquiring a property.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So we always start out with our models are going to underwrite to a standard, what we call GSE debt product, which is going to be Fannie, Mae, and Freddie Mac. So from a sizing standpoint, just to keep things consistent, our modeling is going to assume those products. When we actually get to debt quoting, Phil's going to go out to probably two or three different providers.
Yep.
And get different products and what we call grids. So we're going to actually get to see a grid that'll show different products. They'll be GSE, might be CMBS, might be life company. But we're going to get what I call the menu of debt products for this particular transaction. And what we'll do is we'll go back into our model and we'll size in those debt products and ultimately select the product that's the most advantageous to the deal. Now, I will say for the listeners, the most advantageous debt product doesn't necessarily mean it's the cheapest product, right? You have so many different variables to consider in the debt product. Floating rate versus fixed rate is a good example of a variable. A lot of our equity groups early on, you know, a couple of years ago, they liked that floating product, and now not so much. So depending on who the equity product is or who the equity partner is, could also dictate the product. You also have your term, what kind of exits they are. All of that plays into our analysis on what debt product we ultimately select. But it's a fairly robust process. It's a fairly test-intensive process to just see what kind of debt product we ultimately want to use on the transaction.
Okay. And Phil, let's talk a little bit about how all this debt works. More specifically, there are base rates that generally we start with. Talk a little bit about where do those base rates come from? What is a base rate? Let's go pretty elementary with this at this point.
Sure. So in general, when we're looking, as Ryan talked about, floating rate versus fixed rate are typically the two general criteria that we're looking at. And under those scenarios, you're going to have two different types of indices that are traditionally used for various debt products. One is SOFR, which is S-O-F-R, which is short for Secured Overnight Financing Rate, which is effectively set by the Fed, by the U.S. Federal Reserve. And then the other that we utilize, that's for floating rate deals. That changes typically on a 30-day basis. Lender will utilize that particular indices along with a spread to that number, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then the other is the 10-year Treasury. And the 10-year Treasury is issued by the U.S. government as well, typically bought by institutional investors, but essentially creates a fixed rate methodology for using for the debt product. It'll use the 10-year treasury plus a spread for that particular indices for that particular type of structure. So when we're looking at fixed versus floating, there are different indices that are utilized.
And you mentioned the word spread. Explain what is a spread, why, how do they move, et cetera.
So the spread is effectively the risk premium that an investor in that particular security, whether it be a GSE or Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, a Ginnie Mae investor, a life insurance company, is a spread on top of the indices, SOFR or the 10-year treasury, that they put on top of that particular structure in order for them to determine a rate for that particular debt product. So you have the base rate that we talked about, plus a spread, and that spread is really the risk premium for that investor. That spread moves based upon, it can be everything from differences in asset class, so multifamily will price differently than hotel, which will price differently than an industrial product. So the spread has something to do with the type of real estate classification that we're dealing with. The other thing is it determines based upon the risk profile. The higher the leverage, or higher the amount of debt in a transaction in the capital stack, oftentimes you'll see a wider spread, because the lender in that case, or the investor is taking more risk on the transaction than when you have less debt. So the spread goes lower in those sort of scenarios. For example, a fully 80% loan to value loan today, fixed rate, might have a spread of 175 to 180 basis points, let's say, over the base index. If we were to have do that same deal at 55% loan to value, that spread might be 140 basis points or 145 basis points because of the viewed risk premium between lower leverage and higher leverage for the investor. So that spread moves for a number of different reasons based upon risk on classification of the real estate, as well as the risk as perceived by the lender and or the investor for that particular product.
So the spreads are set by whom?
That's an interesting question. It's really set by the market. And depending on what the end use of that investment is for the investor will create the variability in how that spread is determined. If somebody is buying it for their own account, they may choose to keep a spread that is slightly lower because they want to hold it for the long term. Somebody that might be aggregating loans to put into a pool or a bundle will oftentimes have a higher rate spread on those deals because they may not be delivering that particular investment right then when they buy it. They may be bundling for 3 or 4 months, so they have to have some timing duration risk built into that spread. But generally speaking, the market determines the spread. Individual investors obviously impact, but there's enough liquidity in the real estate market and enough transactions being done that most lenders are trying to stay within a general range of where their competitors are so that they can buy the product at a reasonable price. Because the borrower oftentimes is looking, to Ryan's point, there's a lot of variables. Lowest rate has a tendency to be a key characteristic. So the variable of somebody like CAI will look to as to what their cost of capital is. So the market determines kind of the spread, but that's all driven by a competitive sort of a process for different investors buying the product. They know they need to be within a certain band to be competitive.
Okay. And Ryan, I know you look at rate as Phil alluded. However, there are other factors that are taken into consideration when you're doing this matrix or this grid. And certainly a prepayment options are something that's critical because of our holding period. How do you look at prepayment? And you or Phil might explain how these prepayment penalties, if there is a penalty, how that works.
Yeah, I mean, we can do that. I mean, prepayment penalty certainly is one of the factors. So when we look at prepayment penalty, what I look at first and foremost is what's the hold period of the asset, our projected hold period. So let's assume for a minute that we have a 5-year projected hold period. In that case, what we typically will do is a 7-3 structure with the GSE. So that's going to be a 7-year balloon note with a 3-year prepayment penalty lockout. So what that does for us strategically is our execution of the investment thesis is usually 2-2.5 years. So we're executing the investment thesis, we're locked out from prepayment, and when we're done in year 3, our loan will unlock for prepayment between year 3 and year 7, and you can see we're in a 5-year horizon. So basically, we've got 2 years of flexibility, total of 4 years of flexibility on the loan, but 2 years on the hold period to decide when is the right time to execute a recap or an exit. You can change that around. You're going to pay a little more in rate for a 7-3 structure than maybe, let's say, a 10-9.5. But we don't want to be locked out for 9.5 years, because when you're in that lockout period, if you can either be locked out and or you're going to pay yield maintenance. And yield maintenance is, I'll let Phil explain it, but typically when it unlocks, you're going to pay 1% maybe. But if you're in that hold period, you're going to have to pay yield maintenance. And Phil, I'm going to kick it over to you to explain how yield maintenance works on some of those products. And I will add before Phil takes over, each of the loan products has different prepayments. If you're with HUD, it's usually a 10-year step down, for instance. So you really have to pay attention to that component when you're at it. But still, why don't you take yield maintenance and explain how that works?
Yeah. So when an investor buys a particular product or buys a particular loan or what have you, they're expecting, they're putting out capital, they're buying this particular piece of paper under the auspice that they're going to generate a certain return for that investment for a specific period of time. So using Riot as an example, for a 7-3 sort of a structure, the investor is buying for 7 years, but their expectation is this is going to get, they're going to get paid off in year three. As such, to Riot's point, the rate's going to be higher. In the event you do a 10-9.5, where it's a longer duration for the term, and we have to pay yield maintenance during that 9.5-year period of time, that investor is expecting that that deal is going to be outstanding for 9.5 years. In the event we want to prepay that, then there's a yield maintenance. And effectively what that means is you have to make the investor whole for their expected duration. And in this case, you know, 3 years and or 9.5 years. And you do that by effectively having to pay a premium for the payment. So on a $10 million loan with a 1% prepayment, that's a fixed 1%, you're paying $100,000, and you know that. On a yield maintenance, in a scenario where, let's say, you have a 5% interest rate on that loan and rates have gone down to 4%, what you have to do then is effectively the investor is not able to reinvest those funds at 5%. So you are going to pay a premium for that yield maintenance, because typically you're using the existing treasury at the time when you're prepaying as part of the calculus for determining the amount of yield maintenance. And so you're going to, on that $10 million deal, you may pay $1 million in prepayment penalty if you're paying off in year three on a 10-year deal versus 1%, $100,000. The challenge with it is yield maintenance, when your rate on your loan is higher than what the current market is, your yield maintenance is higher. In the scenario where your rate is lower than the current market, which is where we're at today, your yield maintenance goes down because the investor can actually turn around and reinvest their investment at a higher rate. So yield maintenance is not a defined number. It changes day to day, hour to hour, frankly, depending on the current existing rate of the indices, which typically is the 10-year treasury at that particular date and time. So yield maintenance creates a lot more variability for an investor as it relates to what your exit cost might be for that particular loan if you want to get out early. But to Ryan's point, we're trying to figure out the best way to manage our exit cost through various structures in your debt. And you should be looking at the same thing as, you know, if I'm going to get out of this in X number of years, I want to line up my debt to be as inexpensive as possible during that period of time in which I think I will look to exit the transaction.
Now, Phil, there's another term that's used when we're talking about prepayment called defeasance. D-E-F-E-A-S-A-N-C-E. Explain to our audience, what's defeasance?
Yeah, so yield maintenance effectively is you're paying the yield at the time you close the transaction. It's the time you prepay the pay off the transaction. You're paying that off in cash, and it's being paid to the investor. Defeasance is in a scenario where you have a 10-year deal and you're paying off in year seven and you're doing a defeasance, you're effectively buying matched term duration treasuries. What that means is, I'm going to buy a 3-year treasury because I'm in year seven, I'm paying off in year 10. I have 3 years of defeasance in that scenario. I'm going to buy treasuries that match that 3 years. And whatever the treasury rate of that 3 years is, I still have to make that investor whole for their yield. As such, I, as the borrower, have to make up the difference between what I can get paid in the treasury and effectively what the investor is looking for. The difference is that the investor will continue to get their yield over the remaining 3 years of the duration of that term, as opposed to a yield maintenance where they're getting the cash up front.
Okay. And another term that's been used is loan to value. So it's fairly self-explanatory, but talk a little bit about how that value is determined and what are the typical metrics that we're seeing in terms of percentage of value that is loanable.
So loan to value is typically derived by taking your NOI, your net operating income, and dividing that by your cap rate, or the market cap rate at a given point in time. What's interesting is the value of an asset can be different in different people's eyes. How CohenEzra may underwrite a transaction versus how somebody else who's looking to acquire the same property may look at it can vary as it relates to NOI in terms of what they believe the operating expense income numbers should look like. And then the cap rate is a very much a variable based upon what's going on in the marketplace and what people believe the property to be worth. So in simplest terms, you take your NOI divided by a cap rate, and that cap rate can be agreed upon. It can be set by the seller who said, I want to sell my property at a 5 cap. Whereas a buyer may say, I'm only willing to pay a 5.5 cap. That's where you have a difference in value perception. Normally, this can be solved or remediated somewhat by use of a third-party appraisal, which will help define what the real market value of the property looks like. We use loan-to-value, and lenders use loan-to-value for kind of derivation of how we put together our capital stack. And it used to be that we could get 75 or 80% loan-to-value or loan-to-cost leverage on debt. Today's environment, because of rates being as high as they are, we're being constrained much more by debt service coverage, which means we're seeing more deals in the 60 to maybe 70% leverage sort of a scenario for first lien debt in today's marketplace.
Yeah, I think that our portfolio, Ryan, last time we did a calculation, we're at somewhere in the mid 60% range as far as where we are with leverage. And we've never been real aggressive that way. Typically, when there was positive leverage, which we'll talk about that term in a moment, but having more and more debt was riskier, but it also produced higher returns for the investor. But we've always chosen to maybe leave a little something on the table where that's concerned for the margin of safety of having lower rates. So I would also, Ryan, I'd toss another question to you about floating rate and how we manage risk on a floating rate debt instrument.
Yeah, I mean, how we manage risk on a float is we purchase a cap. So you're going to pay for that up front with post transaction, go to a different firm. In effect, the rate's going to be set and it continues to float as Phil alluded to each month, but there's a maximum that rate will go before the cap kicks in. And so what'll happen is if we hit the cap and exceed the cap, which, I mean, has happened in the current rate environment, then our cap firm will kick back to us the difference between the maximum and the, quote, current run rate of the debt for a period of time. I mean, you can decide how aggressive you want to be with the cap purchasing. Usually on a float rate, you're going to have a 3-year deal with 2 1-year extensions. Best avenue is to buy a cap for the 3 years. That did get incredibly expensive at the end of the run-up to be able to do that as people were watching what might happen with rates. So a 2-year was a lot more feasible for folks to do. You know, the most conservative is you buy it through the full 3-year term and then you're covered until that first kind of extension period exists with the hope that you're going to refi into a permanent instrument. So there's many, many ways, many firms out there that do these caps, but that's how we manage the cap risk on an ARM.
Yeah, and it gets real expensive if you're buying an in-the-money cap versus an out-of-the-money cap. In-the-money cap means that you're buying a cap that's pretty close to where your rate is now. An out-of-the-money cap is obviously a bit higher. There's more room to have the rates run up on you, and that gets cheaper. So as folks can probably tell from this discussion, it's not just a simple fact to go out and talk to a lender and sign a term sheet and do a deal here. There's just so many complexities to it. And Phil, let's talk about the different loan products quickly here. Ryan's used the term GSE several times. Why don't you start there and explain what the GSE is and just quickly, a little bit about each one of these loan products.
Sure. So GSE is government-sponsored entity, which really encompasses Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which originally were standalone entities. But then during the last downturn, there was a need for federal bailout for those particular entities. As such, they now fall under the umbrella and are overseen by FHFA, which is a governmental entity. A lot of their purpose was to do a couple of different things. One, to make sure that both Fannie and Freddie were expending a lot of their liquidity and resources to support affordable and workforce housing. The other thing they wanted to do is they wanted to make, they being FHFA, the regulator, wanted to make sure that there was market availability for multifamily product outside of Fannie and Freddie, who have become the dominant lender. They wanted to create more of a private marketplace. And they've done that successfully since, you know, they took over, I think in 2011, 2012. So those are government-sponsored entities. Fannie and Freddie, they do, you know, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 45% of the total financing in multifamily on an annual basis. They also do senior housing, but I'm focused mostly on multifamily in this conversation. Then you have CMBS, which is commercial mortgage-backed securities. Effectively, what CMBS is different aggregators might put together a pool. So what they'll do is go out and buy a pool of real estate assets, real estate loans, and that can be just multifamily. But normally, most CMBS lenders are aggregating industrial property, hospitality, multifamily, number of different asset classes, and they're combining all of those and they're selling it off into the marketplace effectively as a pool of mortgage loans. As a borrower, we are basically taking the rate that they're generating and, you know, selling the loan to them. And that aggregator then is selling it out to other investors, maybe more retail-oriented investors over time. Then there's life insurance companies that oftentimes are very much in the business. They typically look for higher quality assets, and they look for really strong markets and more core markets. What they're trying to do is they're looking to try and match duration with some of their insurance obligations or life insurance obligations. They oftentimes can have very flexible terms. They can have very low rates, but they have very, very high criteria as it relates to the sort of assets of which they'll put on their books. Then they'll lend against, you know, everything from retail to office to industrial to multifamily. Then you have HUD or FHA, which is actually a governmental entity, not a sponsored entity, but an actual governmental entity whose head of FHA actually sits on the cabinet of the president. They are able to do senior housing as well as multifamily. They have some very unique product that's available, typically with longer leverage, oftentimes with, longer duration. One of the key differences in most of the products that we talk about, as Brian alluded to, will have a 7-year term or a 10-year term with a 30 or 35-year amortization. All of HUD's products or FHA's products are self-amortizing, so you'll get a 35 or a 40-year amortization. You have no forced liquidity. What that means is you don't have to refinance the deal. The prepayment penalty is typically structured as a defined percentage that declines each year for the first 10 years, then it's open at par. So that is a very big difference to HUD. The time frame to get those done is a little bit longer, but it can be very beneficial for long-term holders of real estate. Then you have mezzanine and preferred equity that comes into the capital stack. We're seeing more and more of that now, especially with the lower leverage debt on first lien that we've been talking about. Mezz and pref have slightly different connotations. Mezzanine has a pledge of partnership interest. Pref typically has a priority return on its capital, but may or may not have a pledge of partnership interest. Most lenders prefer preferred equity, not to be redundant there. That has seemed to be more widely accepted than mezzanine financing. But either way, they, in essence, both of them serve as a middle tranche of capital between your first lien debt and your sponsored equity, and oftentimes can be used to help enhance returns because you have a fixed rate on that as opposed to an equity participant that may have, you know, a participation in the full dissolution of the property sort of economics. So it can help enhance your returns as an investor, as a borrower, excuse me. And we talked a bit about floating rate. Typically, floating rate is available on most all of the products except for HUD. HUD only will do fixed rate execution. All of the other areas that we talked about will look at floating rate options.
Well, that's great. Good. There's so much that we can talk about on each one of those loan products. Obviously, we don't have time in this episode, but we've been in a rising rate environment, as we've already mentioned. And I used a term: positive leverage, negative leverage. What that means is that right now we're kind of in a negative leverage environment where interest rates and loan constants particularly are higher than cap rates, the capitalization rates. The apartment market has not capitulated to the point where sellers have been willing to take lower pricing to find an equilibrium between interest rates and capitalization rates. So obviously, when you're in a negative leverage situation, you're in a better position to do less debt than more debt. We like it the other way around a bit more when we're in a positive leverage environment. So I guess the final question I'm going to ask both of you is to tell us, what interest rate do you think will begin to unlock the apartment market at this point? Ryan, I'll start with you.
So this is an interesting question, and I'm not sure I have a direct answer, so I'm going to give the answer that I have. What the market is looking for, I think, to unlock is stability. And so what I mean by that is what's happened over the last year has been hard to forecast, so I'd put it in an unstable category. People can't tell 90 days out what the Fed is going to do. And so it was very hard to underwrite deals. It was very hard to see what exactly is going to happen. So as we're seeing today with the Fed's announcement, and I haven't gotten to read before this podcast what Chairman Powell said in his numbers, but it seems they're indicating they're at the end of rate hikes and that we're going to see easing in 2024. I think that's going to provide clarity to folks that they can start really underwriting deals and figuring out how to make all this work and refinance. And you'll start seeing the deal, what we call the deal folks, who are itching to get deals done, and the capital start to flood back into the market. So I don't have a magic number for myself. I think this stability is going to potentially cause an unlock. That's my view on this.
So do you believe that there may be buyers that are interested in making deals today, even though the negative leverage persists, but do so on a floating rate, believing that the rates are going to come down significantly to the point that they get into a positive leverage situation? Do you see that happening, or do you think that?
Yeah, I think you're going to see some of that. I don't think you're going to see it today. I think you're going to see it maybe a month from now. I mean, I think everybody's holding their breath for today, and now you got the holidays, so. The big National Multi Housing Council conference is coming at the end of January. That's where we usually see a lot of things unlock. And I think everybody's going to start clamoring for the doors now that the Fed has released this information to start seeing that happen. I do think you're going to have folks that are going to be ready to enter short-term loan products, particularly float, with the anticipation of quantitative easing in 2024, and wait to lock in that permanent fixed rate until they hit what they think is the floor. So I do think you'll have opportunistic buyers out there that are going to be in that position, yes.
All right. Phil, do you have a rate, specific number in mind, or a different perspective here?
Well, I don't think it's a different perspective. I believe the same thing Ryan does, that it was very much tied to stability. The interesting thing is that after the Fed meeting that just recently occurred, we have seen just in the last 24 hours, the 10-year Treasury dropped from 417 to 403. 3 months ago, we were at 5%. What that tells me is that there was optimism within the marketplace that the long-term outlook for U.S. paper and U.S. debt and U.S. cost was going to come down. It was going to come down rapidly. And that's in conjunction with what the Fed had begun to kind of lean into, is that they might be slowing down and or stopping their rate rise. So we're seeing the effects of that now. What that means for us from a borrower perspective is if we have long-term fixed rate at 4%, and we have short-term 30-day paper today, which is SOFR, that is currently at 5.32. That SOFR rate won't change till the Fed begins to reverse their policy of raising rates and holding steady, but actually decreasing their rates, because that SOFR number is driven off of that particular sort of happenstance. But they're seeing the 10-year Treasury drop, so I think what we may see is less people going into floating rate options right this second. To Ryan's point, if I'm a borrower today and I'm at 4% and I've got a 150 to 160 basis point spread, so my rate today is 550 or 560 at 65% leverage, I'm likely fixing a rate on that deal as opposed to a floating rate scenario. We're also getting much closer to potentially seeing positive leverage especially if you factor in getting 2 or 3 years of interest only for the first couple of years, and you think everything else is going to continue to work in your favor on rates, by the time you get to the end of that interest only period, you're sitting in a positive leverage position. So again, I don't think it's a specific number. I think that at 4% 10-year treasury, the market can execute. At 5.32 short-term rate, 30-day rate, I don't think the market's going to execute well. I think you need to have the short-term rates pulling below the long-term rate so we get away from this inverted yield curve where short-term rates are higher than long-term, which we've been suffering with through all of 23. We need to see that switch back where short-term rates are lower and long-term rates are higher. If the treasury is going to stay at 4%, to me, that means you need to have your short-term rate between, you know, 3 and 3.25 and with what it should be from a corollary risk position. You would think that'd be reasonable. I think as long as there's stability and people believe that the Fed has stopped in terms of raising rents, we'll start to see some execution in the early part of 24. That's just, you know, but again, I don't think I could circle a rate. I certainly like 4% treasury a whole lot more than I like 5% treasuries.
No doubt. Start. No doubt. Well, Phil, Ryan, thank you very much for an interesting discussion here, one that we haven't undertaken before on this podcast. And hopefully our audience has new understanding about debt financing, and we'll see everybody the next time. Thank you, folks.